This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
It's a tale of two Trumps, both good and bad. We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It's really great to see everybody. Great to be with you on this Wednesday morning. Now, I was caught with an interesting dilemma when I came back because, of course, I was not here yesterday, and I do apologize for that. I was getting chemo, and they have me. I'm down to my last 3 weeks, which is really good. So the week after Christmas, I'm going to be gone all that week. I'm taking that week off. So you will not be able to hear me then because I'll be at chemo from the 26th to the that Friday, whatever day that would be. I guess that would be the 30th. And then New Year's, I'll be off for that, but then I will be back and then only have two installments of chemo left. So hopefully it'll all be over and I'll be declared cancer-free. But that aside, getting away from the personal stuff, because I was out yesterday, I was caught with an interesting dilemma. Because I had fully prepared for and was ready to go with a segment about how Trump was looking very good going into 18. Whether you agree or disagree with his policies politically, Trump had the high ground going into 2018 and looked like he could have a very good next year because of the things going on in Washington and in the administration. And yet, as Trump tends to do, right after he has made a major accomplishment, he's done something that he's put forward that makes him look good, that will be politically expedient for him, that will help the party, that will help his agenda, so on and so forth, Trump started backpedaling a great deal. And there were several things that have come out in the past day, the past 24 hours, that kind of do the opposite of what he's planning on getting forward that's going to wind up hurting his agenda, hurting the conservative cause, and could wind up, if he goes through with them and they end up the way they usually do, could even end up with him losing the White House in a couple years. I'm not saying that would be an absolute certainty, but it is a possibility, and it could also really hurt the party, lose some seats, the House, the Senate, that kind of thing. So what I've got here is a tale of two Trumps. So we're going to look at the good and the bad. Trump is actually, like I was planning to say the other day, right now is set up to have a really solid 2018. And he would probably need a couple more legislative victories, because especially in the society we have today where everything's fast-paced and people lose their attention very quickly, you need to have accomplishments. You can't just rest on having a good end of 2017 to have a good 2018. So there is something to be said for that. He would have to have some legislative accomplishments. There would have to be some foreign accomplishments in 2018 for him to have a good year. But the point is, he is sitting right now at a pretty good place, because the new tax bill, as many of you know, passed the Senate the other day. It does have to go back to the House, and the House has to vote on it. I'm not sure about it. I could see the House passing this. I think it probably will pass, if I had to guess. But there may be some House representatives that want to tweak some things, which would trigger a second vote in the Senate. I'm not sure. Like I said, I'm not in love with the Senate bill. There's some things in it I really like. There's some things in it that I really don't. Some because it was left out completely, or some because it doesn't go far enough. But regardless, this is a mediocre bill at best. But the Republicans really need a win right now. This would be viewed as a win. It is a step in the right direction. There's not something in this bill, so far as I know, that I absolutely hate, that I think is a bad idea. It's just, when you're looking at massive sweeping tax reform, keeping all seven tax brackets and decreasing them by only 2% on the individual side is not exactly sweeping tax reform. It's a tweak at best. It's a good tweak. Again, like I said, step in the right direction. Not necessarily a massive win. I would put this under the category of moderate win, personally. Now, they still need the House, but they're probably going to get it. I expect the House to pass it sometime today, probably not long after my show, if everything goes accordingly, because they're expected to take it at noon, and that will be Eastern time, which of course means it'll be right as the show is ending. So if we get any news on that, I'll try to keep you up to date, but it probably won't happen until after the show today. Also, it repeals the individual mandate. That is a big win, because that was something that they couldn't even get through. You remember they had a vote on essentially just that. It was what was called the skinny repeal. Their last ditch effort to quote-unquote repeal Obamacare really only repealed one tiny part of that massive law. However, it was the worst part of that law. The individual mandate, besides being completely unconstitutional, also has the side effect of being a moral nightmare. So the fact that it gets rid of the individual mandate is actually a really good thing, positive for people who care about liberty, who care about being able to make their own decisions. Now, on this, the liberals are now fussing, because according to the CBO, there are about 20 million people that could, quote unquote, lose their insurance. Now, I use the word lose very loosely, and here's what I'm going to do. And explain this. So what they're saying is they're kind of assuming that everybody that is no longer required to have the care will drop it, which is not true. Because at least 7 million of those 20 million people are on Medicaid, and they're paying about $20 a month. Will some of those people, because there's no longer an individual mandate, because they are no longer required to have health insurance, or they will get penalized for it, is that going to happen? Yeah, maybe a few of them, but $20 a month, not exactly. I mean, you could subscribe to Netflix and Hulu and you're already at over $20 a month. So for the vast majority of that 7 million people, dropping their health insurance when they're only paying $20 a month for it, that's not going to happen. Are some going to drop it? I don't know, probably. But if you were paying $20 a month for health insurance, would you drop it? Exactly. So most of those 7 million people are going to stay on their plan. And so losing health insurance would actually just be most of them voluntarily keeping it. And we wouldn't really be losing that many that way. Now, okay, that's fair. That's only 7 out of the 20 million. Let's look at the other 13 million. The other 13 million might drop because they don't want it. And that's a good thing. 13 million people not being compelled at gunpoint or face fines and penalties for purchasing a product, that is a positive thing. If they don't want it, they shouldn't have to have it. I mean, this is not something that we would go down that road logically with anything else. If the government said, for example, let's just take, I don't know, some other commodity. Like, let's say corn. Because that's a simple one to use. We'll say, what if the government just all of a sudden said, you must buy 5 pounds of corn each month? Well, that would be a weird law. But then as soon as somebody proposed legislation that took that law out of effect, that people didn't have to buy corn, they're going to say, there's going to be 13 million people that don't have corn. Well, maybe they don't like corn. Maybe they don't want corn. Maybe they eat other things. This is a good thing for liberty. There is no way under our Constitution that you can justify having the federal government mandate a person to purchase a product. That should never be done. It is against everything that our founders stood for. The government compelling you to buy something. People should be allowed to make their own decisions. If they don't want health care, they shouldn't have to buy health care. That's a completely different situation. And so liberals can crow, maybe all 13 million lose their coverage. Okay, if they don't want it, that's up to them. If they'd rather do that and not pay a fine, that's their business. I don't understand. Well, actually, I do understand why the individual mandate was put in there. What I don't understand is liberals trying to make the case that somebody being forced to purchase a product is a good thing. That I do not get. I get why it was put in there. The individual mandate was put in there because they needed a way to force all the young, healthy people that weren't going to be drawing a lot out of the system to be in the system. because without that, it would have collapsed, which Obamacare is on its way to collapse anyway, because a lot of those people just said, yeah, I'll just pay the fine. A lot of people said that. And a lot of people did. And so their stupid plan didn't work anyway. This particular part of the bill didn't work very well. And so they're going to lose the few part of the 13 million that didn't want it. Some of them, they won't lose all of them. They're going to lose a big chunk of them because those people don't want health insurance, and that's fine. Some of these people that are losing it are uber wealthy and just want to pay out of pocket. That's also okay. They're still taking care of themselves. They'd just rather put money in the bank and then save it for a rainy day and then pull it out as they need it because they think it's the more economic way to go. Good for them. That's fine. That's just the way that it works. All right, so we're going to go back. There are a few more things I want to talk about that put Trump in a really good place for 2018. We'll discuss that when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Governments could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source, from the King of Kings and the Lord of all the earth, General John Dickinson, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. So there is a... looks like I got Joe Hunk. Oh, that was another communication, but I have a tweet here. It's just between me and Joe Hunks, who's out this week. We're going to try to work something out, though, that he'll be able to come in for upon further review. So I will let you know about the status of that on Thursday, something to look forward to. But in the meantime, let's talk to somebody else. Let's go to the phones. We've got Dennis on line one. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. I have two quick things, and then I want to ask you about the tax bill.
Okay.
First, I want to clear some things up because sometimes things are said and they're never addressed, and, you know, it just goes weeks and weeks and months, and then a person doesn't get ready to clear it up. First thing is, first of all, Kelly, I don't wear panties, okay?
Okay.
And second of all, when I called the other day to ask you was Brian Pence there, I wasn't calling in to go anything against him or do anything against him or talk about him.
I don't think you were.
No, we had agreed on something.
Okay.
And that's what I wanted to talk about. And I like to discuss fatherless children because it's a big problem, and I work with a lot of
Dennis,
people.
I didn't assume that you were going to attack the guy.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't.
Your statement. That's what you projected about me, and you always project.
See, Dennis, you take things, first of all, you always take things the wrong way. If there is a right way and a wrong way.
You tell me I wear panties, how should I take that?
Look, my mom has been using that insult on me, her own son, for years whenever I start whining like a little girl, which is what you were doing.
Oh, I was whining because I was stating truth about being a Christian and owning slaves at the same time?
No, what you were doing is you were whining because I use George Washington as an example of a good Christian man. I've given you facts. I've given you references to back that up that talk about his Christianity, that talk about his faithfulness, and that he was actually an abolitionist that was against slavery.
Okay, that might have been 50 years after he had owned slaves, but the whole
no, he still he, first of all, he owned slaves until he died. And second of all, he was an abolitionist when he was writing he and James Madison and the other people at the Constitutional Convention were writing it. He tried to have it written in there and actually played a political trick on the people from Georgia, the representatives of Georgia, to try to get slavery taken out of the Constitution to where it would have been illegal for all 13 of the colonies
to own slaves. We're just not going to agree on that.
Yeah, because you won't accept the facts because they don't agree with your worldview.
Okay.
Now, what did you have on the tax bill? Let's get back on subject.
I'm not going to agree on that.
Because you don't like it.
Huh?
Yeah, you won't agree with it because you don't like it. It doesn't agree with your worldview. Ergo, you look at the facts and say, I don't like those facts. I'm not going to accept them.
No, that is not the truth, Caleb.
I'm sorry, that's the way it is.
No, it is not. If you allow me to explain, then you know, fine. But if not, as you normally don't, then I'm fine with that, too.
Well, if it bothers you so much, why do you call in over and over?
Because I have a right to call in. I can call in wherever.
Actually, you don't have a right to call in. I don't have to take you on my show.
Well, then you can ban me if you like. Whatever you choose
But I don't because I like having conversations with you, but you keep drudging up these old facts and you won't let things go. Let's stay on topic. Let's talk about what's going on today.
No.
Yes, if you're on the show, You have to talk about what's actually being talked about on the show.
Yeah, and I have a right to clear up false information said about
no,
me.
No, you don't. Not on the air.
Yes, I do.
You can talk to your friends about it, but you don't have a right to be on the show. Now, let's get back on subject. Dennis, let's get back on subject. Let's actually talk about what's going on the show today. If not, if you're going to start out every single call with dredging up every gripe that you have about previous calls, I'm just not going to take you anymore.
Well, that's fine. It was never addressed, and I just addressed it. Now I'm ready to move to the third thing.
All right, go ahead. I've been asking you to do that for about three minutes now.
I wanted to clear other things up first. I just don't like the lies you say about me.
Okay, Dennis, if you're going to do this every single time, I'm not going to keep bringing you back on the show.
I don't do this every single time.
Stay on subject. Dennis, stay on subject. Stay on subject. Do you have something to say about the tax bill or not?
No, I have something to add.
Okay. I'm sorry, but if you can't stay on subject, I can't keep you on as a caller. We got stuff to talk about. I'm not going to be drudging up old arguments every single time just because somebody has their feelings hurt about it. That's not productive. It's not good for the audience. You want to private message me? You want to get into a conversation with me over that way? There's plenty of ways to do that. You can go on the website, NewsRadio 1440, and you and I'll talk about it and hash it out. But I'm not going to make the audience sit through old arguments every single time. All right, so let's move on. First of all, going back to what we were talking about earlier with the tax bill, with the individual mandate, both of those things go back to the way that liberals are talking about it. It goes back to one simple thing. You just heard at the CNN at the top of the hour, Elizabeth Warren. You just heard her saying up there that this is a massive giveaway to the wealthy. That was her quote. They had the soundbite of it. That's what this tax bill is. It's not tax reform. It's a massive giveaway to the wealthy. Now, think about this. She actually used the word handout is the terminology she used. Only in a crazy liberal mind, devoid of logic, could you get to the point to where, whether it's a rich person or not, letting them keep more of their own money is a handout. In other words, not taking money that they earned from them, that's not a handout, or that is a handout, but giving people a check every month for not working, that's not a handout. You have to be completely devoid of all logic and reason to reach that conclusion. And it all goes back to this one simple thing. Liberals do not trust people to make their own decisions. Same thing with the individual mandate. That's why they put the individual mandate in there. They do not trust that you, as a responsible adult and a citizen of the United States, is smart enough or clever enough or has the means or whatever it is to take care of yourself when it comes to health care. And they don't really trust you in making any of your other decisions as well. We can see this in blue cities, where they actually specifically limit things like the intake of the content of your sugar or salt in your own food. They do not trust you to make your own decisions with anything. They just assume you're kind of a moron, and big nanny state is the word I'm looking for. They have to hold your hand and take care of you every step of the way, because otherwise you might do your own thinking, and they can't have that. So you've got this, that is really the idea that undertows this entire thing. That they believe that they have to rush in and make all the decisions for you, because otherwise you might make a wrong decision, and they can't have that. Part of freedom means people are going to make bad decisions too. Take it away, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio if you want to. You can get on the conversation there. Persisting Patriot just tweeted me. Just a second ago, so we're having a conversation on there. So that's another way to interact with the show. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. Be sure to go there and follow me. Now, With this whole Donald Trump thing, the reason that he's going into 2018 looking really good, looking really strong, part of it, and I think that this may be incredibly significant for the way we look on the world stage, and I've been very pleased with the way that this administration has handled this. Most of the Trump administration, I've been very upfront with you, and I'm actually about to get on with some things that Trump is doing that might ruin his 2018 as well. So, you know, it's not going to be all positive. But when it comes to Donald Trump, I think that maybe one of the best things that he has done as far as foreign relations thus far is declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And the way that Nikki Haley came out and just absolutely eviscerated the UN for how they constantly are giving Palestine and the different Middle Eastern countries the benefit of the doubt and then always seem to thumb their nose at Israel. I mean, the way that she just went after them was phenomenal. But that aside, Israel is our greatest ally in the Middle East. We need to treat them that way. They're the only ones that have any semblance of goodwill towards us. Even our quote-unquote allies in the Middle East don't really like us. Israel does. And if there is ever a time where we needed a friend in a certain part of the world, it is Israel in the Middle East. So we need to acknowledge, I mean, the capital of Jerusalem, that's where the prime minister is. It's been that way for years. We needed to acknowledge that. And kudos to Trump for doing that. That's something that's really good. I know that there are people on the left that don't like that, but the vast majority of Americans, they stand with Israel. There are controversial issues for sure. And, you know, there's some things that Israel does that isn't perfect. I understand that. Sometimes I've disagreed with decisions that Israel has made, and I understand that. But by and large, the general sentiment of the American people is they stand with Israel. And so that is a win for Donald Trump, declaring Jerusalem the capital. It makes sense. And now he needs to follow through on it. Because declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel is all well and good, but that can all be undone when somebody else takes his place. When a Democrat president, you know, takes power or whatever, all those policies can be undone. What can't be undone is if he builds the embassy in Jerusalem. So Trump needs to get on that right now. That needs to be a priority. He needs to do that before his first term is up. The embassy needs to be built and established in Jerusalem right now, as soon as possible. Because once that happens, that's not something that with the stroke of a pen, a new president can just change. And it makes sense. I mean, from an just from an infrastructure standpoint, it makes sense. It's practical. The embassy should be in Jerusalem because that's where Israel's government is. That's where all its officials are. It makes no sense for them to have to go back and forth between where it is now and Jerusalem. So from a practical standpoint, everything, Trump needs to go ahead and move that embassy as soon as he possibly can. Otherwise, it's just empty talk. But still, you know, I want to applaud him and give him kudos where kudos is due. And that's something that he really needs to follow up on, and that will help him have a good 2018. The economy is looking really good. I was looking at the Before the Bell segment on CNN just before this started. There is a chance that the Dow is going to hit 25, and that would be a major accomplishment. We've seen the economy really booming right now, and a lot of that has to do with the tax bill. The promise of a lower corporate tax is something that is very attractive to businesses right now looking to increase their profits, reinvest, maybe hire some new people. Every president, I will say, gets slightly more blame as well as slightly more credit than they probably need to when it comes to the economy. So I don't want to overstate how much Trump has had to do with it. I think that he's had for sure a positive effect on it. But let's look at this objectively. Trump, what economic policy has Trump put into place that helped the economy? Well, so far, none. None. Now, one thing that he has done that has helped the economy sort of in a roundabout way is that, and he was talking about this just the other day, is that they have not passed new regulation. They have been cutting regulation. They've made several cuts that were essential, that were necessary to make, and that has really helped business. That has helped the economy. And that I'm not trying to understate the importance of that. I'm just saying that legislatively, there is no economic policy that Trump has signed into law. The regulation thing is really helping, and when you're looking at the stacks and stacks and stacks, literally, I think in 2013, the stack of new regulations just that year was 11 feet high. If you printed them all out and stacked them one piece of paper on top of another, 11 feet high. That's way overkill. And you can see how that much new regulation and that much uncertainty in the business sphere is going to cause a lot of instability. So Trump not doing that, not being the regulation guy, and not having all this red tape has really, really helped. And I don't want to understate the importance of that. But as far as legislation, there have been no new policies that help business up until this tax bill. That will help business, and cutting the corporate rate from 35 to 21 is a big, big win. So let's look at this. Sorting through this, why is it that Trump deserves credit for the economy if really just the regulation, the executive side of it, is all he's been able to pull off? He's basically helped boom the economy with nothing but rhetoric. Just saying that regulations are going to drop and taxes are going to go down and we're going to get that done, that instilled confidence in the populace. That's all it took. And that's something that Barack Obama didn't do. Based on everything that Obama was hearing, business leaders were sitting there wondering, am I going to have a new mountain of new regulation? Is he going to raise my taxes? Am I going to have to provide health care for every employee that I have now? Is he going to make me buy, you know, the best plan there is? There were all these uncertainties constantly within the Obama administration when it came to business leaders, and they didn't know what to do because of that. All Trump's saying is, just saying he will do things has caused a spike in the economy. Imagine what's going to happen when a new policy like this tax bill actually comes through, where there's an actual change in the way business is run and the amount of money businesses are able to keep. Because this boon so far has been basically on Trump's rhetoric alone. There have been other factors in it. I don't deny that. But when it comes to that, look at how much a president just having the appearance of somebody that is pro-business has had on the economy. So far, that's all we've really had. And that has caused this boom. That has caused a big boom in the economy. I'm not saying that it's the only cause or anything like that, but look at the difference that you're seeing between one commander-in-chief and another. So once an actual policy change comes through, we could see a much bigger boom. And I'm hoping, and this is what I really want, that if he and Congress see the positive effect that this tax bill has maybe 6 months from now, maybe looking at a second tax cut, maybe looking at more of what works, maybe actually cutting the individual taxes down to a couple of brackets and, or, you know, maybe two or three brackets. I'd rather have just one bracket and have a flat tax, but I don't think that's going to happen. And then cutting the individual by a little bit more. I would love to see that. I don't know that they'll actually pull it off and do it, but I would love to see something like that go through. And because of that, the left is on their heels because they put all their money on one number, and that is hating Trump. That is their rallying cry right now. Resist, become ungovernable, the opposition. Whether you like Trump, whether you don't like Trump, whether you're on the left or the right, you have to admit that if Trump all of a sudden becomes a popular president, and I don't know that he actually will, but if his policies start working really well, if the economy is really booming and Trump is going to receive at least some credit for that, if he's got a couple of major legislative wins under his belt, and let's not forget Neil Gorsuch, who Trump appointed, we're going to have another season of Supreme Court decisions. And when that comes through, any decisions that Neil Gorsuch is on that prevail, that's going to be seen as an accomplishment for Donald Trump when people are considering that. That's going to be taken into consideration. So that's another thing that Donald Trump's going to be really getting credit for. If Trump comes out of this smelling like roses, and he may not, but that makes the left look all like a bunch of childish morons because they've been crying and whining all this time about how horrible Trump is and how terrible he's going to be for the economy and he's going to wreck it and he's going to destroy it. People are going to remember that. And so the Democrats would be politically very wise to hedge their bets and not put all their money on just hating Trump. They have to have some kind of policy. They have to have something they can get behind, they can campaign on. Because otherwise, if their whole thing is, we just don't like Trump and we have to stop Trump, and that moderate voter is looking at the job Trump is doing and saying, he's not doing such a bad job, and I got a little more extra money in my paycheck, and the economy's doing really well. And if that happens, the Democrats have nowhere to go. So it would be wiser politically for the Democrats to hedge their bets and put some money on hating Trump and put some money on some other things in case the Trump thing doesn't work out. Because if that's the case, and I say this as somebody who may have put a little bit too much money on the let's stop Obama thing back in the day. Don't get me wrong, we needed to stop Obama. He was still one of the worst presidents we've ever had. However, it's smart for the Republicans to have a plan and to have something ready to go, and they would look better. The Democrats should learn from that and not spend all of their time talking about how terrible Trump is. Come up with some ideas of your own. Come up with some of your own policies. And I know I don't like to give advice to the enemy, but if I were giving advice, Democrats, really, you got to spend some time on something else. Because if Trump turns out to be a popular, and I don't know if he will or not, he could still very well screw this up, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But if that is the case, then you guys have nowhere to go because you've spent all this time talking about just that. We'll be back in a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call, weigh in, and let me know what is on your mind today. Now, the other day, of course, you heard that there was the Amtrak wreck. Apparently, the train was going 80 miles an hour on a 30-mile stretch of track. The engineers didn't think it was going to be a big deal because they had taken curves that are actually a little bit sharper and taken them at a speed equal to or higher than 80, and everything had gone fine. So, in their estimation, everything was going to go okay, but it derailed, and this particular train fell on the busiest roadway, one of the busiest roadways in the state. When it fell down there. So I believe that was I-5 is the road that it fell onto. This particular line, it was the first time they had ever used it. This was the maiden voyage, as it were, for a new line from Seattle to Portland. And unfortunately, it kind of had a similar story to the Titanic, which is it messed up on its very first voyage. So very first time this train is running, winds up derailing off the track. Unfortunately, it wound up killing 3 people and injured about 100. So, of course, our thoughts and prayers go to everybody that was involved in that. It wound up hurting several people, and luckily, it wasn't much worse, because it could have been a lot worse, considering everything that happened here. However, one thing that I wanted to get into about this is that, as tragic as this accident was, and as much as we hate to see something like this happen, the president was quick to draw this crisis like a weapon to push his political agenda through. And this is one of the big policy things that Donald Trump could really mess up his 2018 if he pushes this forward. So, first of all, y'all know my 48-hour rule. I think that it is wise and it is polite to wait for at least 48 hours after a crisis happens to try to talk about that crisis in a way that furthers a political agenda. I'm not saying it can never be done. I'm not saying you can't use something as an example. I'm just saying let's wait at least 48 hours, if nothing else, out of respect for the families and the people involved. And I'm not going to rehash that whole thing right now, but I think that it's wise to do it. It's wrong when the right does it, when guys like Donald Trump do it. It's wrong when the left does it. When the left does it, you know, some kind of mass shooting or something like that, it always comes out and the left tries to use it as political fodder. If there's a terrorist attack or something like that, the right usually tries to use it. You can have those debates and you can use something like that as an example for a policy, but it's wise and it's also polite to give it a little time, wait until you have more details, and to have a sense of priority or propriety about it. So Trump tweeted out right after this took place. I mean, when workers were still going through the rubble on all this, trying to get everybody off the road and everything, Trump tweeted out, "The train accident that just occurred in DuPont, Washington, shows more than ever why our soon-to-be-submitted infrastructure plan must be approved quickly. $7 trillion spent in the Middle East while our roads, bridges, tunnels, railways, and more crumble. Not for long." Now, he said he made this same point in his speech on Monday, where he doubled down on this, saying that this was the big example of why we had to have infrastructure spending. Because everything's crumbling, apparently, and we really need that new infrastructure. Now, does this tweet make a good point that it is ridiculous, the level of money that we are spending in foreign aid? Yes, spending $50 billion on foreign aid is beyond stupid. Building roads and bridges and buildings in other countries, that's, first of all, it's not what the military was designed for. It's not what we're supposed to do. So I agree with Trump on making that point. However, does spending a lot of money in a stupid way justify spending a lot more money in another stupid way? No, it does not. A new $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which is what Trump originally proposed, spending $1 trillion is not justified by spending $50 billion somewhere else. That's like saying, that's basically the "well, he did it too" argument. Well, other people have done this dumb thing, so it's okay for me to do this. It doesn't justify a stupid action. Furthermore, his whole point was, this is the example, this shows why we need infrastructure spending. This was the maiden voyage of that train. Brand new. First trip that train had ever made. The tracks were new. The train was, it doesn't get more new than the way this train was running. This wasn't something that happened because the infrastructure was bad. This happened as, from what we can tell, a result of human error. Usually when trains derail, that is what happens. Now, we don't know exactly, and people are still looking into it. It may have been another cause as well. But the point is, not being new enough was not the issue. This was a brand spanking new train on brand spanking new tracks. It had never made this trip before. So using this as your big example of why we need infrastructure spending makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. This is one way the president could screw this up. When he's set up to do very well this next year, $1 trillion stimulus that is bigger than Obama's stimulus package is not a winning strategy. Now, as usual, the Trumpets, the people who blindly follow Trump, they're going to stupidly follow along, even though they hated it when Obama spent $1 trillion on infrastructure spending, and it drove them out of their minds when he was spending that level of money, and it should have. But because Trump does it and because he's Trump, they're just going to go along with it. And that's not all the people that voted for Trump. That's a chunk of his base that just love Trump no matter what he does, even if it's the same thing as Obama. And Obama spent nearly $1 trillion. And what happened? Well, he spent $1 trillion. Shouldn't we be okay? I mean, can our infrastructure really be that old if we spent $1 trillion on it? It really didn't do that much. And so this idea that we have to have infrastructure spending, it's imperative that we spend all this money, I don't buy into that. And part of the reason that I don't buy into it is because we've seen all this before coming from the other side, and it didn't make any sense then either. Bad ideas are bad ideas no matter who comes up with them. Now, reportedly, Pelosi and Schumer will not be at the table on this, which may cost votes. Good. I hope that makes it fail. Democrats and the media will accuse him of wasting money, and this time they'll be right. They'll be justified in doing so. Really bad move for Donald Trump if he moves forward on this. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Economic nationalism sweeping the nation, but that may not be such a good thing. We go there now on Tactics.
Just try your best. Try everything you can. And don't you worry what they tell themselves. You're away. It just takes some time.
Welcome back, all. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. At Tactics Radio is the Twitter handle. And we are in the middle of the week. It's hump day. So,
hump day.
Getting ready for that weekend, which, of course, this weekend is big because of Christmas. So, it is just about upon us. I'll be heading off to Kentucky to be with my family. I really wish all of you a Merry Christmas and hope that y'all have a safe and wonderful trip wherever you may be going. But let's go ahead and get into this real quick. I was watching Trump's speech on Monday, which took place after my show, so I didn't get to do any analysis on it since I was out yesterday. And kind of a mixed bag. Trump's speech had some high points for sure. First of all, very patriotic, which I was, as always, glad to see. That's something that Trump doesn't really struggle with. Getting out of the Iran deal and Paris Climate Accords, those are huge. He was listing those as accomplishments, and I think that he should. Beating ISIS, obviously a big accomplishment. Now, that's not all him. Even though to his credit, ISIS was starting to lose a lot of ground near the tail end of the Obama administration, and Trump really put the last nail in that coffin, so they've lost almost all the land that they had controlled at one time, so ISIS is being beat back right now. That's good. Getting our NATO partners to pay. Trump's just a touch too anti-NATO for me, but his idea about getting the other people to pay their fair share and pay what they actually agreed to pay, since American and primarily American forces are what's defending them, that's a fair argument to make. If we're going to be in this agreement, this massive agreement with lots of other countries, that's something that needs to happen. They need to be able to pay for the protection that we're offering because that cost us money. And so I actually agree with him on that. I thought that what he said in the speech about NATO and our NATO partners was fine. Cutting regulation, that's something that I actually talked about and talked about him doing this past year economically that's really helped boom the economy. So cutting regulation, definitely a positive thing. He said that there were, I believe, 22 regulations that they've cut for every single new regulation that they've made. Now, part of that is just not that they've cut a ton of regulations, just that they haven't made many new ones. But I'm okay with that. I'm perfectly fine with that. That's a good number for him to throw out there. So I think it may have been overstated slightly, but that does not mean what he has done on regulation is not a really good thing. And the border wall. That was something that is good for him to talk about. I know that it gets his base up. I know that the vast majority of Americans, whether they agree with the actual wall or not is a different story, but there is some level of we got to start getting this under control. Some people on the left don't. Some people want open borders, and I understand that. But the majority of Americans are with Trump, at least on the idea that the border needs to be secured. Now, some of them disagree on the means and methods and how much it's going to cost. But as a general rule, more Americans agree that something needs to be done about the border than not. So that was a win for Trump on that one, the talking about the border. The only problem with that is Trump can't build the border wall himself. He needs Congress and the House to do that. The House in particular has to originate that because it would include spending. So we've passed that legislation many times before, usually with Democrat support. That needs to be done, and it needs to be done as soon as possible. But, you know, we've been trying to get that for 30 years. I don't know that we're going to get that through. I really hope that it can, and you know, I've said for a long time that if Trump actually gets that through, I'll eat my hat. I would be happy to eat my hat if he actually is able to pull that off. I would be perfectly all right with that. I would be pleased to be wrong. So definitely some highlights in the speech. I don't want to act as though everything in the speech was bad, but there was one major thing that I have a problem with, and I'm going to spend a couple segments here trying to explain that. On the other hand, you're looking at national security, which was sort of the thrust of the speech. He talked about it moving to America first, but if you're looking at the actual meat and potatoes, what he actually said he was going to do, not much different than Obama's national security policies. And I know that's going to freak some people out. I mean, but I'm just saying, look at the actual policies and the decisions that Trump is going to make and has made versus the ones that Obama did. A lot of it's more of the same. Now, Trump's version of it was far more patriotic and talked about America as being a force for good in the world. And that's nice, but that's really just changing the packaging. Whereas Obama was presenting, let's use the example of food. If you were presenting your dinner to you, Obama was presenting it on a trash can lid, whereas Trump was putting it on a really nice plate with a nice fancy steak knife and fork. Well, that's good, but it doesn't change whether or not the food is good or not. That's all presentation. Again, step in the right direction. Much rather have a plate than a garbage can lid. But the question is the food good? And when it comes to this national policy, a lot of it just sounded like the same kind of stuff that Obama wanted to do. So, first of all, with Russia, he said, well, let's just try to be buddies with Russia and reset Russian relations. That plays right into the Russians' hands. The Russians are not there to help us out. They're not our allies. They're not going to help us in the long run. Russia is looking out for Russia. That doesn't mean we can't have a decent relationship with them, but they view us as a geopolitical enemy and they want to see us taken down a peg. They're not somebody that we can trust. They're not going to be a strong ally for us because that is where the place where they're coming from. And when you start with that premise, it's impossible to get to a good place that is mutually beneficial. The best case scenario for us and Russia is that Russia remains mostly benign. That's the best case scenario. And frankly, it's pretty unlikely that that'll be the case. So the whole let's be buddies with Russia thing, I don't necessarily think that plays in the president's favor. Now, that being said, I will give him credit. At least he did mention them as a potential threat, which Obama didn't do early in his presidency. He would have listed them as a threat late in his presidency, but he certainly did not think of them as a threat earlier. In fact, halfway through his presidency, remember, he mocked Mitt Romney for saying they were our biggest geopolitical threat. Laughed him off the stage, and that was 4 years into his presidency. And then promised Putin more leeway after the election was over. So this try to be buddies with Russia thing, it doesn't work, and Trump shouldn't try it. Another thing, it looks like we're still arming the bad guys in the Middle East. Remember that arming rebels is what gave us ISIS in the first place. They were mostly using American hardware and training that they learned from us trying to set up shop in Iraq. A lot of those people wound up joining ISIS and using American bought guns and other resources to help them to do so. When we're in the Middle East, and this thing is such a quagmire, and we have a choice between helping a legitimate government, which I don't even like the idea of helping another government, to be perfectly honest, and arming rebels because we want to do some kind of regime change, we usually wind up arming the rebels, and then the rebels wind up shooting at us later on in some form or another. It's not a good policy. There just are not very many good guys to help out there. And so we're arming people that could very well turn out to be our enemies later on, and that's not a winning strategy. So that was one kind of misstep that the president made. The only really big difference on national security that I saw was building the wall, which Trump, like I said, can't do by himself. So Trump definitely needs to sort this out. This speech was kind of a mixed bag. National security-wise, I just don't think that it was a rousing speech or anything, but I want to get to economic nationalism, which was a massive, massive part of Trump's speech, and we're going to do that in just a second. Before we do, though, I want to tell you about our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. These guys have been in business for 50 years. There's a good reason these guys have been in business for 50 years. They know what they're doing, they do a good job, and they do it at a good price. Look, a lot of us are going to be traveling for Christmas. And that's good. It's good to go see the family, go see grandma and granddaddy or whoever it is that you go over to be with. This is a time for being with family, and that's something to be applauded. But your car needs to be able to get you there. Because goodness knows, you don't need to be broke down driving somewhere on Christmas Eve when half the shops are closed and you're in a town that you don't know, so you have no idea which shops might be open and which may not be. You don't want to be stranded on the side of the road. If you need anything, a tune-up, you need to get your heater fixed, you need to have your engine looked at because it's cranking kind of slow, maybe because of the cold weather or whatever, go to Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. That's who you need to talk to. The experts there, they know, you know, regardless of make and model, they can find what's wrong with your car. They can find somebody that can. So go see them on the Troy Highway and tell them that I sent you. That is Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. And we will talk about that. Economic nationalism and protectionism played a very prominent role in Trump's speech yesterday, and we're going to kind of break that down when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 28:19-20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world.
Welcome back, all. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in and chime in. However you want to do that, that is fine. We will be happy to have your call. And also, you can tweet us at Tactics Radio. That's always an option for you to get in touch with me as well. So getting back to this Trump, the Trump speech the other day, one thing that did really bother me is that this is something that Trump will not let go of. And again, this is something that could ruin his chances in 2018 and ruin his chance possibly even to get reelected in 2020. So the economic nationalism that he veered off into was quite a mess. And we're going to get into that in just a second. But before we do, we're going to go ahead and take a call on line one. Good morning. Who's this?
Hey, good morning, Caleb. How you doing?
Doing good. Good to hear from you, my friend. What's going on?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, talking about the Amtrak situation, Rago, just kind of something just kind of sparked in my brain when you were talking about it. And, you know, talking about Trump, talking about the necessity to really kind of revamp our infrastructure. Well,
sure.
You know, there can be an opposite point made to that.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't Amtrak pretty much ran by the federal government?
It is run by the federal government.
Absolutely. So he could have used this would have been a great opportunity to not talk about expanding the size and scope of federal government and spending and infrastructure and creating debt. He could have used this to say, you know what? Amtrak is losing money every year. It loses millions of dollars every year, but they always vote to keep funding it.
Yeah, the last I saw, they were losing it was some ridiculous figure, like $18 million on food service alone. You're on a train. How do you lose money on food service? They don't have any other options.
Well, the thing about it, and this is my opinion, I think I'm right. You know, we live in America here. We like our automobiles. We like that personal freedom. We like to drive around. We're not into mass transit like these Western or Eastern European countries are. You know what I'm saying? So they're not getting – they get used – I equate them to the city bus line service here in Montgomery. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's probably not a lot of people using them, you know, but nevertheless, people do use them, but just not that many. But I could see where President Trump could have said, you know, this would be a great time to privatize Amtrak, you know?
Yeah, perfect opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
And it's not that private companies can't sometimes make mistakes. Accidents happen regardless of that. If you're in that business, that's something that you have to deal with. But the point is, you wouldn't be saying our tax dollars are being spent and look what we're getting out of it. It would be just the people that are riding the train that are paying for that.
Absolutely. And he's got so much, for a lack of a better reason, ammo. I mean, he could say, listen, this is the most heavily regulated transportation industry in the federal government, Amtrak. They have regulations from A to Z. They got regulations for the conductors, the personnel that are on here, and every single thing they do. So if you look at it, that government is so great and efficient, there should never, ever be any accidents related to an Amtrak train. But yes, there is, even with all the regulations, the massive government oversight in that industry.
Right, because government regulations don't magically make things happen.
Absolutely. Just like the shooter, I know this is a little bit different, I mean, you know, rabbit trail, but just like the shooter that, when the Navy, well, what was it, the military failed to turn his psychological reports over. I forget what branch of the military he was in.
Right, you're talking about the Sutherland Springs shooting where he really should have been barred from having a gun, but I think it was the Air Force actually. Didn't turn it over to the authorities, and so they didn't know about that. So his background check didn't red flag him.
Exactly.
And human error happens. That's just the way it is.
Right. So I think he probably should have used this opportunity. And I agree with you 100%. At least 48 hours, man, after some of these things happen, just for respect to the family, you know. But after that, you know, just make the case of reducing the size of government.
No, I couldn't agree more. This was if you were going to use this as political ammo, it could be done that way, and that was a golden opportunity that I do feel the president, unfortunately, he kind of missed the mark there.
Yeah. Well, all right, Caleb. Well, you have a great day, my man.
Hey, you too. Thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Great call. And going along with that and going along with this idea of sort of missed opportunities and misplaced, I think, good intentions, but something that certainly is not helpful is what was going on in his speech that was just kind of riddled with this economic protectionism. Now, this is the only policy. I pick at Trump all the time for flip-flopping on things, that he's kind of a blank slate, that he doesn't really have his own policy ideas, that he's not really strong in one direction or the other. This is an exception to that rule. This is one thing that the president has been crowing about and preaching about and has done ever since he's been in the spotlight. This is something that he has never changed his mind on, which I'm a fan of consistency. I think consistency is a good thing. I talk about it all the time. However, in this particular instance, it's something he's consistently wrong on. He really likes this idea of economic nationalism, protectionism, as it were. And this was one of the few policies, actual policies, that he seemed really passionate about in the campaign. Now, Donald Trump seems passionate about a lot of things, but I'm talking about if you're actually looking into the nuts and bolts of how government works, this is one of the few things that's an actual policy stance that he took that he seemed really passionate about and that he really got fired up about. And I hate to see that he's wrong on this one issue that really seems to get him up in a dander, get his dander up, as it were. And some people are blaming this on Steve Bannon's influence. Believe me, I don't like Steve Bannon. I've made that incredibly clear. And this is a policy that Steve Bannon himself subscribes to, which he's also wrong on. But when it comes to whether or not the reason Trump was doing this was because of Bannon, I don't buy that argument just because, like I said, this is one of those rare policies that the president is just super passionate about talking about. And I think that probably pre-existed Bannon. I don't think that Bannon is the one that convinced Donald Trump that economic nationalism was a good thing, that protectionism and coming up with massive tariffs was a good thing because of the way that he talked about it. So I don't really buy into that argument. I blame Steve Bannon when Steve Bannon's done something wrong. And goodness knows, I think he's one of the most dangerous men in the country, but I don't think you can pin this on Steve Bannon. I don't think that this is his fault. So Trump basically, in this speech, threatened to have a massive tariff war with every country in the world, that if you have tariffs and raise tariffs on us, that we're going to raise tariffs on you and we're going to start bringing jobs back into this country. Look, that is a fine and noble goal, but the truth is history is not on the president's side on this one. And we'll get into that in just a second. Nobody ever wins a tariff war. Never has, never will. When two countries get into a tariff war, all it does is raise taxes for the end consumer. That's all it does. It is a tax on the person that buys the final product. Because here's why that takes place. Let's just say you're China or Russia or whatever country that you are. We'll use China for right now. If you're China and they put a big tax on something that you import a lot of, let's say, I don't know, toys or something like that, something that is primarily made in China that gets sold in America. Well, what happens to that product when that tariff takes place? The United States says, we're going to up tariffs on you by 15%, and you're going to pay a 15% tax on everything, this commodity that you import. Do you think that that country sits there and goes, well, darn, now we have to pay 15%. That sucks. No, they raise their prices. If the government of China doesn't raise tariffs on something else that America imports, which is also a problem, because that means now that the people over here are selling less of their product and we're getting less money coming from other countries into our borders, which hurts our economy. So that's the first problem with a tariff war, and that's why I say nobody ever wins a tariff war, because it's just two countries going back and forth raising tariffs on each other, and nobody ever gets any gain out of it. All it does is cause economic instability. But that aside, for the moment, what happens to that product? Well, the companies and or the government raises its prices to compensate, because they're not going to eat that loss. So what happens is the price of whatever commodity is tariffed, in this case, in the example we're using, toys, that goes up for people that are buying them, because it costs more to produce, because there is a cost of compliance with that tax. So the only person that's really hurting is the person buying the product. The government, it's a sneaky way to tax somebody, because the end result is where that money's really coming from is out of your pocket. If America were to increase tariffs by a large amount on commodities, then whoever buys that commodity, that tax is on Americans. That's why it was such a stupid idea for Donald Trump to come out and say the way that Mexico is going to pay for the wall is we're going to raise tariffs on Mexico. Well, that just guarantees that Americans are going to pay for it. That basically ensures that people who buy things from Mexico, whoever's buying that end product, that means that they're going to be the ones paying for the wall if that's the case. Now, that's not come forward. There's been no legislation for that. I'm not trying to say that's something that actually happened. But when that was his idea to get Mexico to quote-unquote pay for it, all that was going to do was ensure that Americans would be paying for it. Because effectively, that's what a tariff does. So we're going to talk a little bit more on this and talk about the history of tariffs and why Donald Trump's could really benefit here from studying up on it and learning from history, and his advisors could do the same. That will be in just a second when we come back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Now, kind of in response to Trump's tweet, or Trump's speech, the Cato Institute put out this article addressing economic nationalism and some of what I posted it on the Twitter feed at Tactics Radio. If you want to get in touch with me that way, you can do that. Also, I post a lot of things on there daily. You can check that out if you want to. The Cato Institute really does a great job, and I posted that to my Twitter feed. So you can check out the article there. And put out this really great article addressing economic nationalism. Multiple studies on import restrictions from 1950 to 1990 showed that for each job saved, when we're talking about tariffs, and it does save some jobs, it brings some jobs back, that is true. I'm not trying to say that it doesn't. But the cost for each job saved was about $620,000. Well, we'd be better off just paying five or six employees and increasing the size of the government jobs if we were going to do that, or giving that money directly to people. That would be a lot cheaper than $620,000 per job. That's a lot. And I guarantee you those jobs were not paying $620,000 apiece. There was one exception that they could find where the tariff seemed to actually help the industry out. But that one exception was the bicycle industry. And even that, it helped not hurt their foreign competition. So what happened is they put this tariff in place, and it did help the industry. But it also helped their competition as well. So it's more likely that the bike industry just all of a sudden took off for reasons unrelated. And the industry just started to see a boom at that point. And it just happened to sort of coincide with the tariffs that took place. So when it comes to actually saving an industry or increasing sales, the science on whether or not tariffs does that is pretty... Actually, there's really not any proof for it. I mean, like I said, it does save some jobs, but at very, very high cost. And so usually what happens, or every time that it's happened, rather, in America, we come out on the losing end of that bargain. Tariffs don't help. They don't help in America. They don't help other countries. Other countries put tariffs on things too, and it doesn't help their industries either. So this is just a basic economic law. It has nothing to do with America or anything else. And so another thing with protectionism, sometimes they cite the revival of Harley Davidson. This is their big example. They say, look how well Harley Davidson is doing. They were about to go under and we put tariffs on foreign motorcycles and that saved the brand. It saved Harley Davidson's. However, a closer look at those tariffs and what it actually did shows that at best it counted for only 6% of the brand's profits. Well, if that's the case, then how did Harley Davidson actually revive? Because they made some changes to their brand, they changed some of their economic policies and what they were doing at their company, and that caused the brand to take off because they were offering a good product. So regular business stuff had nothing to do with the government. The government coming in with tariffs does not save local brands. It never has. Even in Harley Davidson, which they constantly use as this golden example of how protectionism saved a particular industry in an American brand. And I like Harley Davidson. I do. I like their stuff. I have a couple Harley shirts. I love their jackets. I don't actually love their bikes just because I don't own one. So that's the only problem with that. I like riding on Harleys on the rare chances that I get to, and it's a quality product. I just don't have one myself. So I can't really speak to that personally, but this is nothing for or against Harley Davidson, but their revival is thanks to them and changes that they made. It accounted for a measly 6% of their profits, so it didn't do anywhere near what they promised it would do, and it certainly would not have had a big enough impact to have saved that brand. That brand saved itself. Also, another thing that's important to note is that when you're talking about Harleys, Harley's market, especially back then, to a completely different base than foreign bikes do, and they would tell you that. In fact, that's like comparing Ram to Hyundai, saying that putting tariffs on foreign cars is what saved Ram trucks. Now, Ram trucks was never in trouble. I'm just using them as an example. You could use another company. I'm using Ram specifically because they only make trucks. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Hyundais are cars. They market to different people. They're not in direct competition. There's some overlap of competition, but not much. So saying that Harleys are competing with Yamahas and Ducatis and things like that doesn't make any sense. They market to different people. They have a different base. And so taxing foreign bikes didn't really do much to save Harley. Any bike enthusiast would have told you that. You don't even need to talk to an economic advisor or somebody familiar with the case. Just talk to a biker. They'll tell you. Yeah, people that are buying Yamahas and people that are buying Harleys, not the same folks. You could maybe make the comparison nowadays with, I don't know, like Honda Goldwing might be marketing to a similar. But especially back then, there's really not a case that you can make that that is what helped Harley make a comeback. All that did was screw Yamaha customers and price some of them out of the market. And what did that do? Well, that hurt jobs and sales at dealerships for Yamaha here in America. It also hurt people that were part of Yamaha's infrastructure. So that would cost American jobs as well. And this is really a testament to why government intervening in the market just does not work. Because for every job you create, you're losing a job somewhere else. Every job that gets saved, it loses several more. So let's just say for the sake of argument, because this is another thing that's really big, one of our biggest competitors, China. Let's say that we raise tariffs on all clothes made in China. We're going to bring the textile industry back to America. First of all, it's not going to happen because the way that our society is set up is different now. We couldn't revive the textile industry, but let's just use that as the example for a second. Odds are that is not going to bring textile jobs back to America, but let's just pretend that it does. And let's say that it works the way it's supposed to. okay, now what happens is Walmart and Target and Academy, they all have shirts for the same price as a more higher-end clothing market like Belk, Banana Republic, you know, some of the nicer places. Those shirts are still there. They're just the same price as all those higher-end places. And so you're getting less clothes and spending more money for the ones that you get if you shop at any of those places. You're getting less return, and it's costing you more money. And what happens to the jobs? Well, the American truckers that ship the clothes there to the stores, they're seeing a decrease in sales, so they don't have as much to ship, so some truckers lose their jobs. And they have a drop in labor at the retailers themselves, so now Walmart and Target and Academy and any of those places that sell t-shirts for about $20 that are made in China, well, they're seeing a dip in sales because they have to hire less staff and they make less money, which means less money is going to the company as a whole. They have to lay off some people to account for that because their sales are going down. Okay, let's look at the importers, exporters, the people that are actually bringing those products from other countries. Well, they're not bringing in as much product anymore because they've decreased the demand for them because the prices went up. So now some of those people are out of jobs. See, this is the problem that you have. Our economy is so interconnected, and there's so many people involved in the final product getting to your hand as the consumer that you can't fiddle with it, because if you do, it has a chain domino effect of unintended consequences that follow with it. So yeah, maybe you save one textile job, but you lose three or four more with the retailers, the people that are shipping, the people that are bringing it into this country. And the consumer gets hurt because he's paying more for the product. That's why I say nobody ever wins a tariff war. All it does is hurt their own citizenry. It's even worse for ag commodities. I was using corn earlier today. Let's use corn again. Well, actually, let's not use corn because corn is really resilient. We'll use something like tomatoes. It's even worse for ag commodities because some can't be grown here at certain times of the day. If you're going to a restaurant, you're ordering something with tomatoes in it, odds are that tomato probably came from Mexico. Why? Because it's winter. You can't grow tomatoes in America in the winter. It doesn't work that way. Our climate's not warm enough. So what you're really doing there is you're, especially with ag commodities, you're really hurting people, and they're forking over a lot more money for their food and their grocery bills and their bills at restaurants and are going up because some of those commodities cannot possibly be produced in America at certain times of the year, and some can't be produced here at all. Not to mention, the price of food is kind of like the price of gas. It affects everything. So you raise the price of food, the price of everything goes up. And this is what I'm trying to get to. Mr. President, if you want to completely ruin the now booming American economy, the fastest way to do that is by raising taxes, and a tariff is a tax. A tariff is not an exception. It is a tax just like other taxes. It taxes you in a less direct way, but it's still a tax. And if the president supports this policy, he is going to kill all of the momentum he has going into 2018. And so those are the two biggest problems that Trump has looming on the horizon. If he embraces economic nationalism, and if he does what we were talking about earlier, which is going after this massive trillion-dollar stimulus spending. Both of those are really bad ideas, and Trump deserves any criticism that he gets for them. So if you want to have a really good 2018, the president needs to back off of some of those policies. Chaplin's report is coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. And you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Chaplain's report is on right now, so we're going to get you going for the rest of the day. Jesus heals many lepers, and each one tells us a different story. We see different stories coming out about Jesus at different times in his ministry of him curing leprosy. But each one is unique. And we're going to go over one today that is really brief, but speaks volumes. Not a lot of detail in this one. We only have a sort of a one-sentence exchange between each man, the leper and Christ himself. But it really does speak volumes. Now, to give you a little context into this, this is right after the Sermon on the Mount. And this is something that Matthew's gospel does a lot. So what you'll have is Matthew does this sort of switch back and forth. He'll have these really big sections of teaching moments. And then after the largest one, which is the Sermon on the Mount that he just got finished with, he transitions to deeds that Jesus was doing. And then he'll transition back to Jesus teaching for a while and so on and so forth until you get to the crucifixion. So Matthew does this quite a bit, is he'll have these large sections of one or the other. And we're just transitioning right after the Sermon on the Mount into a section of narrative where it's talking about Christ doing different things. So Matthew 8, 1 through 4. When Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him, and a leper came to him and bowed down before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I am willing, be cleansed." And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you tell no one, but go and show yourself to the priest and present the offering that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." So this last little line about him going to tell the priest and Moses, this was part of the process of entering back into society once your leprosy was cleansed. So the priest had to look at you. You had to offer a sacrifice to show your gratitude for God healing you. And so he tells him to do all the things that the law of Moses would have required. But what strikes you as odd and different about this cleansing? What is different about this cleansing that we have very little detail on compared to some of the other lepers that are cleansed? Well, for one, look at the way that he has this reaction to Jesus. He says, "If you are willing, you can." That's his line. He understands who Jesus is. He has just seen him preach this amazing sermon. And he's saying, "You can heal me. That's not a question. I am in no way questioning that. I know that if you want to, I can be clean. My question is, are you willing to cleanse me?" That's how he asked Christ to cleanse him, which is really significant. That took an amazing amount of faith in Jesus. Because keep in mind, this is really early in Christ's ministry. This guy has not heard about Christ walking on water. You know how I know that? Hasn't happened yet. He hasn't heard about him raising Lazarus. You know why? Because it hasn't happened yet. Most of the miraculous things that are attributed to Christ have not happened at this point. He's done some miracles and he's become a little bit famous. That's why he has a crowd following up him up into a mountain. But as far as a lot of his miraculous deeds, this guy didn't have that to go on. And yet he has faith in Jesus, absolute faith, that if this man wants me to be cleansed, I will be cleansed. That took an amazing amount of faith in this man. He understood that it was not Jesus' ability that would have been the limiting factor in this, that Christ had the ability to do so. I think we can take a lesson from this. We need to pray with the same mindset that this man prayed, that when we make a request to God, God is powerful enough to grant it. That is not the question. Well, what is the question then? Is God willing to do so? Because God has the ability to do so. His power is absolute. So logically, if God answers one of our prayers no, then there is a good reason. We have to assume that. Logically, if God is all powerful, if he can do all things, then if he says no, there's got to be a reason for him doing that. Could be that God has a better idea. Some unforeseen circumstance that we're in that God can see that will actually be better for us in the long run. Or could be that God wants us to act. Sometimes when we pray for things, it's not that we're doing anything wrong per se, but God wants us to act on it and he wants us to be in a different place in our life when that blessing comes. So sometimes there's a little bit of a delayed yes. It's a no right now. God is saying no to us right now, but he may say yes later. Whatever it is, he has his good reasons. Sometimes God is protecting us from something. God knows that what we're asking for would actually be spiritually dangerous for us, and he holds off on it for now. He may hold off on it forever. Maybe we're asking it amiss. But the point is, God's power is always absolute, and he always wants to do what's right for us. Like a loving father, he only wants what's best. And sometimes he is willing and eager to help, but sometimes he must lovingly say no. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.